Thank you for coming. Please join us in welcoming Mr. Chris Hedges.
Thank you very much. Now, I just want to, before I begin my talk, you know, as you heard, I've spent most of my adult life covering conflict, covering war, and I don't do it anymore. I stopped. I ended in Gaza for the second Intifada, or a Palestinian uprising, and got caught in a very bad ambush, which I think I'll mention later. But that was enough. I've just spent most of my life living around a lot of violent death. But I was very angry during the Gulf War, or during this current war with Iraq, because I felt that the images and the way war was being presented was so mendacious and untrue. And I got together with a bunch of combat veterans, including two combat surgeons, four West Point grads. All of us had varying opinions about the war. Some of them actually supported the war in Iraq quite strongly. But what united us was a complete disgust for the way war was being portrayed, mostly by the cable news networks, as a kind of game, as kind of war as entertainment. And there had been a book that came out at the end of World War I called What Every Young Person Should Know About War. It was written by a lawyer named Harold Roland Shapiro. Didn't sell many copies. But he had had, as a lawyer, a client who'd been very badly wounded in World War I, and was seeking compensation. So he went back and read the medical records, and he was appalled at what he found out about the reality of war, what he found out in those studies of war, as opposed to the myth or the image of war. And he did this book in a question and answer format, which he then sourced it to the military studies. So we set out and we did the same thing. Now, of course, there's far more studies than there were then. Those studies that he worked on were primarily medical. We were able to draw on a lot of psychological studies. For instance, one of the problems that the Army found after World War II was that only 20% of soldiers in combat situations fired their weapons. So the question was, how do we raise that firing rate? And they brought in Army psychologists to do it, and instead of using bullseye targets, they created human targets that pop up and down. And they employed the techniques in operant conditioning, in essence, the same techniques you use to train a dog, to train people to overcome this natural reluctance most of us have to killing. They know how long you can stand sustained combat, which is 60 days. After 60 days of continuous combat, 98% of a unit will have a psychological breakdown or collapse. And that 2% that does not, according to this study, shows a predisposition to aggressive psychopathic personalities. So in other words, after 60 days of combat, you either go crazy or you were crazy to begin with. And the last thing we did, I'm just going to read you one selection because this stuff's staggering. I mean, it really, I think, rips back the curtain on, and none of us are pacifists. I mean, a friend of mine, Colonel Hughes, was a colonel in the Rangers, 3 tours in Vietnam, 3 Purple Hearts, Silver Star. He supported West Point grad. But all of us were worried that as a country, we just failed to understand at this point what war is, that the images were so sanitized and given a kind of coherency and fantasy, in essence. And the last thing we did was went to, just not endear me to my agent, of course, we went to the publisher and we argued the price down. They wanted to sell it for $15 and we fought it down to $11. Because we wanted kids on minimum wage, those kids, unlike you, who are going to go into the Army to buy it. I'm just going to read one passage, and I'll give my talk. This is a question in the chapter called Weapons of Mass Destruction. Remember the weapons of mass destruction, the ones that the Iraqis don't have? It's called, What Will Happen If I Am Exposed to Nuclear Radiation But Do Not Die Immediately? The Office of the Surgeon General's Textbook of Military Medicine states, and this is a direct quote, fatally irradiated soldiers should receive every possible palliative treatment, including narcotics, to prolong their utility and alleviate their physical and psychological distress. Depending on the amount of fatal radiation, such soldiers may have several weeks to live and to devote to the cause. Commanders and medical personnel should be familiar with estimating survival time based on onset of vomiting. Physicians should be prepared to give medications to alleviate diarrhea and to prevent infection and other sequelae of radiation sickness in order to allow the soldier to serve as long as possible. The soldier must be allowed to make the full contribution to the war effort. He will already have made the ultimate sacrifice. He deserves a chance to strike back and to do so while experiencing as little discomfort as possible. Now, I've spent most of my adult life in war. I began 2 decades ago covering the wars in Central America, where I lived for 5 years, then 7 years in the Middle East, and finally 3 in the Balkans covering the war in Bosnia and Kosovo. My life has been marred, let me say deformed, by organized violence that year after year was an intimate part of my existence. I have watched young men bleed to death on lonely Central American roads and cobblestone squares in Sarajevo. I have looked into the eyes of women kneeling over the mutilated bodies of their husbands. I have stood in warehouses with rows of corpses, including children, and breathed death into my lungs. I carry the ghosts of those I worked with, my comrades now gone. I have seen how war deforms individuals, communities, and nations. And I too know that deformation, that brutality, that seductiveness, which drew me into its embrace. We are now, as we sit here tonight, trapped in a bloody war of attrition in Iraq. We have blundered into a nation we know little about and are caught between bitter rivalries and competing ethnic groups. Iraq was a swamp for the British in 1917. It will be a swamp for us as well. We have embarked on an occupation that, if history is any guide, will be as damaging to our souls as it will be to our prestige and power and security. We have become tyrants to others weaker than ourselves, and we believe falsely that because we have the capacity to wage war, we have the right to wage war. Once you master a people by force, you depend on force for control. Isolation always impairs judgment, and we are very isolated now. Read Antigone, where the king imposes his will without listening to those he rules and dooms himself, or Thucydides' history. Athens' expanding empire saw it become a tyrant abroad and then a tyrant at home. The tyranny Athens imposed on others, it finally imposed on itself. As William Butler Yeats wrote in Meditations in Times of Civil War, we had fed the heart on fantasies, the heart's grown brutal from the fair. It is 1967 in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and we have just become Israel. Our empire has expanded. We have become pariahs. We are propelled forward not by logic or compassion or understanding, but by fear. We have created and live in a world where violence has become the primary form of communication. We have built an alliance against terror with Ariel Sharon and Vladimir Putin, two men who did not shrink from gratuitous and senseless killing in the Israeli-occupied territories and Chechnya. We have become the company we keep. And much of the world, certainly the Muslim world, which is 1/5 of the world's population, most of whom, I will remind you, are not Arabs, see us through the prism now of Iraq, Palestine, and Chechnya. And this prism is one that is igniting the dispossessed and deteriorating by the hour our own security and safety. The attacks on the World Trade Center illustrate that those who oppose us, rather than coming from another moral universe, have been schooled well in modern warfare. The dramatic explosions, the fireballs, the victims plummeting to their deaths, the collapse of the towers in Manhattan were straight out of Hollywood. Where else but from the industrialized world did the suicide bombers learn that huge explosions and death above a city skyline are a peculiar and effective form of communication? They have mastered the language we taught them. They understand that the use of indiscriminate violence against innocents is a way to make a statement. We leave the same calling cards. We delivered such incendiary messages in Vietnam, Serbia, Afghanistan, and Iraq. It was Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara who, in the summer of 1965, defined the bombing raids that would kill hundreds of thousands of civilians north of Saigon as a means of communication to the communist regime in Hanoi. The seduction of war is insidious. It appears to be a way to eradicate our enemies, to banish from the world of the living those who would do us harm. And at a time when we are afraid, it gives us a false sense of power and safety. Of course, we never saw war in the coverage from Iraq. The press always masks the essence of war, which is death, from public view. As in the Persian Gulf War, the coverage was presented as a game, as entertainment. Commentators on the cable news channels reveled in the power and might of our weaponry, and by extension, our own personal power. We watched neatly packaged video clips fed to the press by the war makers. We were spared the pools of blood, the agony of the dying on the other end. It was clean and neat and tidy and wildly out of context. There was the technological capacity to show you war. We could have watched live footage of a young Iraqi soldier with his legs blown off by an anti-tank mine dying in the sand, something I saw in the first Persian Gulf War. But such coverage would hardly have boosted ratings, hardly made us want to wage war. We were fed the myth the press almost always feeds us in wartime, and kept from seeing. For the myth of war, the myth of glory and honor and patriotism, sells newspapers and boosts ratings. Real reporting does not. Look at CNN, Fox, MSNBC. Nearly every war correspondent sees his or her mission as sustaining civilian and army morale. The identification of reporters with the units they cover is insipid and dangerous. In wartime, as Senator Hiram Johnson reminded us in 1917, truth is the first casualty. There was no more candor in Iraq or Afghanistan than there was in Vietnam. But in the age of live satellite feeds, the military has perfected the appearance of candor. We as a nation have lost touch with the essence of war. After the defeat in Vietnam, we became a better country. We were humbled, even humiliated. We asked questions about ourselves we had not asked before. We were forced to see ourselves as others saw us, and the sight was not always an attractive one. We were forced to confront our own capacity for atrocity, for evil, and in this we understood not only war, but ourselves. But this humility is gone. The good name of war has been resurrected. It began under President Reagan in Grenada and Panama and culminated in the Persian Gulf War. We were led to believe in the same way the doomed empires of the late 19th century believed that our technology would make us invulnerable, a lie sadly unmasked every day as I speak in the streets of Baghdad. War is the pornography of violence. It has a dark beauty filled with the monstrous and the grotesque. The Bible calls it the lust of the eye and warns believers against it. War gives us a distorted sense of self. It gives us meaning. It creates a feeling of comradeship that obliterates our alienation and makes us feel, for perhaps the first time in our lives, that we belong. War allows us to rise above our small stations in life. We find nobility in the cause, feelings of selflessness, even bliss. Once in a conflict, the shallowness of much of our lives becomes apparent. The fruitless search to find fulfillment in the acquisition of things and wealth and power is laid bare. The trivia that dominates our airwaves is exposed as empty chatter. Moreover, war allows us to engage in lusts and passions we keep hidden in the deepest, most private interiors of our fantasy life. It allows us to destroy not only things, but human beings. And in that moment of wholesale destruction, we feel the power of the divine, the power to revoke another person's charter to live on this earth. The frenzy of this destruction, and when unit discipline breaks down, or there was no unit discipline to begin with, frenzy is the right word, sees armed bands crazed by the poisonous elixir our power to bring about the obliteration of others always delivers. All things, including human beings, become objects, objects to either gratify or destroy, or both. And almost no one is immune. The contagion of the crowd sees to that. Force, Simonville writes, is as pitiless to the man who possesses it or thinks he does as it is to its victims. The second it crushes, the first it intoxicates. Those who have the least meaning in their lives, the impoverished Palestinian refugees in Gaza, the disenfranchised North African immigrants in France, even the legions of youth in the splendid indolence and safety of the industrialized world, are all susceptible to war's appeal. I do not miss war, but I miss what it brought. I could never say I was happy in the fighting in El Salvador or Bosnia or Kosovo, but I had a sense of purpose. And this is a quality war shares with love, for we are also able to choose fealty and self-sacrifice over security for those we love. This is why war, at its inception, always looks and feels like love, the chief emotion war destroys. We are tempted, maybe even encouraged, to reduce life to a simple search for happiness. Happiness, however, withers if there is no meaning. The other temptation is to disavow the search for happiness in order to be faithful to that which provides meaning. But to live only for meaning, indifferent to all happiness, makes us fanatic, self-righteous, and cold. It leaves us cut off from our own humanity and the humanity of others. The ancient Greeks understood the perverse attraction between love and death in wartime. When Achilles kills Penthesilea, the queen of the Amazons in the Trojan War, he falls in love with her as she expires on the battlefield. He murders love, and once he murders love, he himself is doomed. He courts death. Aphrodite, the goddess of love, had an illicit affair with Ares, the god of war, who is hated by nearly all the other gods, with the exception of the god of the underworld, to whom he steadily brought new souls. We feel in wartime comradeship, and we confuse this with friendship, with love. There are those who will insist that the comradeship of war is love, the ecstatic glow that makes us in war feel as one people, one entity, is real. But this is part of war's intoxication. Think back on the days after the attacks on 9/11. Suddenly we no longer felt alone. We connected with strangers, even with people we did not like. We felt we belonged, that we were somehow wrapped in the embrace of the nation, the community. In short, we no longer felt alienated. As this feeling dissipated in the weeks after the attack, there was a kind of nostalgia for its warm glow. Wartime always brings with it this comradeship, which is the opposite of friendship. Friends, as J. Glenn Gray points out in his book, the warrior's reflections on men in battle, are predetermined. Friendship takes place between men and women who possess an intellectual and emotional affinity for each other. And many of us will admit that we never really had a friend, and even the most fortunate of us have very few. But comradeship, that ecstatic bliss that comes with belonging to the crowd in wartime, is within our reach. We can all have comrades. The danger, the external threat that comes when we have an enemy, does not create friendship. It creates comradeship. And those in wartime are deceived about what they are undergoing. This is why once the war ends, these comrades again become strangers to us. This is why after war, we fall into despair. In friendship, there is a deepening of our sense of self. We become, through the friend, more aware of who we are and what we are about. We find ourselves in the eyes of the friend. Friends probe and question and challenge each other to make us more complete. They draw the secrets out of us and finally know our inner core of being. In comradeship, the kind that comes to us in patriotic fervor, there is a suppression of self-awareness, self-knowledge, self-possession. Comrades lose their identities in wartime for the collective rush of a common cause, a common purpose. They are like erotic lovers. In comradeship, life is ecstatic and corporate, as opposed to friendship, where life is singular and individual. In comradeship, Gray reminds us, there are no demands on the self. This is part of its appeal, and one of the reasons we miss it and seek to recreate it. Comradeship allows us to escape the demands on the self that is part of friendship. This is why once war is over, once the danger that links us together is past, these feelings vanish. In wartime, when we feel threatened, we no longer face death alone, but as a group, and this makes death easier to bear. We ennoble self-sacrifice for the other, for the comrade. In short, we begin to worship death, and this is what the god of war demands from us. Think finally of what it means to die for a friend. It is deliberate and painful. There is no ecstasy. For friends, dying is hard and bitter. The dialogue they have and cherish will perhaps never be recreated. Friends do not, the way comrades do, love death and sacrifice. To friends, the prospect of death is frightening. And this is why friendship, or let me say love, is the most potent enemy of war. We do not see war in the images of war presented to us in films and novels, nor in the mythic narratives the government and the press spins out for us. We never saw war in the televised images from Iraq. The war was always carefully packaged, the way tobacco or liquor companies packaged their own poisons. The titillation was there, but in doses we could digest. The reporters gave us war that had a coherency and logic war never has. We tasted a bit of the exhilaration, but without the fear. War from Iraq was always seen through the prism of the U.S. military, and it came complete with manufactured heroes, feel-good stories about our own, and an enemy that was always painted as barbaric and uncivilized. We can, from the safety of the United States, thrill in the perversity of war, even as we watch films or read books that are meant to denounce war. It is almost impossible to produce anti-war films or books or documentaries that also present images of battle. It is like trying to condemn pornography while showing erotic love scenes. The prurient fascination with violent death always overpowers the message. There is a film by the French filmmaker René Clément called Le Jeu Interdit, or Forbidden Games. It is about two children who play war games in France in World War II. During the entire film, they bury things. They are obsessed with death. But there is only one scene when they are fleeing with a column of French refugees and are attacked by German planes, when we see images of battle. In that scene, the little girl's parents are killed. She is told her parents have been buried. She imagines her mother and father under the earth. The boy and the orphan girl are shown in the village, and all they do is bury dolls, dead bugs, animals, until they have to create corpses to bury. Their lives, their focus, their actions are concerned only with death. This, for me, is an insight into the brutalizing effect of war, what it does to culture, to children, and to civilization. Death is inherent to war. Yet we are sadly unaware of how war distorts us, how it brings out within us the morbid, the brutal, the macabre. We embrace instead the abstract words of glory, honor, courage, patriotism that mask the reality of war. Abstract words that in combat are not only rendered hollow, but obscene. War is part of the modern industrial landscape. Indeed, its tools are often the cutting edge of technology. By World War I, we had created ways in which thousands of people who never saw their attackers could die in an instant. And weapons that carry out this impersonal mass slaughter are beautiful. They are crafted, sleek, and harbor within them awesome power. The machines of war, the planes, the tanks, the heavy machine guns, the huge hulking howitzers and the helicopters are pieces of art. I have seen them at work. They are angels of death streaking through the sky. I was with a unit of guerrillas in El Salvador when some Huey helicopters raced in over a lake to hunt us down. We hid in the ruins of an abandoned village, darting from wall to wall and standing with our backs to the shattered bricks so our hunters could not see us as they passed low overhead. Yet even as I looked up at these machines that were trying to kill me, I found them seductive. Once in a conflict, once we live in the midst of the fighting, we are moved from the abstract to the real, from the mythic to the sensory. No soldier after a few seconds of combat believes in the myth of war anymore. And this is why wounded Marines jeered John Wayne when he visited them in a hospital in World War II. When this move takes place, we have nothing to do with a world not at war. The world, when we return to it, is viewed always from the end of a very long tunnel. There they still believe. There they do not understand. We feel different, wiser, greater. And this experience is so overpowering that if we can control our fear, we go back to seek it out again. War is addictive. Indeed, it is the most potent narcotic invented by humankind. The first time I was in an ambush was in the Salvadoran town of Suchitoto. It was a dreary peasant outpost made up of stucco and mud and wattle huts off the main road. The town was surrounded by the Farabundo Marti National Liberation Front rebels, who, when I arrived in El Salvador, were winning the war. The government forces kept a small garrison in the town, although its relief columns were frequently ambushed as they ambled down the small strip of asphalt surrounded by high grass. It was one of the most dangerous spots in the country. The rebels launched an attack to take the town. A convoy of reporters and cars marked with TV and masking tape on the windshields hightailed it to the small bridge that led to the lonely stretch of road into Suchitoto. We stopped for the familiar ritual of getting high, something as a print reporter who could scramble to safety I did not do, but something the photographers who would stand and take pictures found a necessary balm to their nerves. Then we moved slowly down the road, the odd round fired ahead or behind us. We made it to the edge of town where we ran into rebel units, now accustomed to the follies of the press. On foot, we moved through the deserted streets. The firing from the garrison became louder as we weaved our way with rebel units to the siege that had been set up. Then as I rounded a corner, several full bursts of automatic fire rent the air. Bullets hit the mud wall behind me. We dove into the dirt. The rebels began to fire noisy rounds from their M16 assault rifles. The scent of cordite filled the air. Rebels around me were wounded, crying out in pain. One died, yelling in a sad cadence for his mother, his desperate and final plea slicing through the absurd posturing of soldiering. At first, his cries haunted me. Soon, I just wished he would be quiet. The firefight seemed to go on for eternity. I cannot say how long I lay there. It could have been a few minutes. It could have been an hour. Here was war, real war, sensory war, not the mythic war of movies and novels I had consumed in my youth. It was horrifying, confusing, numbing, and nothing like the myth I had been peddled. I realized at once that it controlled me. I would never control it. In a lull, I made a dash across an empty square to find shelter behind a house. My heart was racing. Adrenaline coursed through my bloodstream, but I was safe. I made it back to the capital and, like most war correspondents, soon considered the experience a great cosmic joke. I drank away the fear in a seedy bar in downtown San Salvador that night. Most people, after such an experience, would learn to stay away. I was hooked. Drawn into the world of war, it becomes hard to escape. It perverts and destroys you. It pushes you closer and closer to your own annihilation, spiritual, emotional, and finally physical. I covered the war in El Salvador from 1983 to 1988. By the end, I had a nervous twitch in my face. I was evacuated 3 times by the U.S. Embassy because of tips that the death squads planned to kill me. Yet each time, I came back. I accepted with a grim fatalism that I would be killed in El Salvador. I could not articulate why I accepted my own destruction and cannot now. There came to be a part of me, maybe it is a part in all of us, which decided I would rather die like this than go back to the dull routine. During the war in El Salvador, I worked with a photographer who covered the war, had a slew of close calls, and then called it quits. He moved to Miami and took pictures of tepid domestic stories for one of the news weeklies. But life in Florida was flat, dull, uninteresting. He could not adjust and soon came back. From the moment he stepped off the plane, it was clear he had returned to die. And just as there are some soldiers or war correspondents that seem to us immortal, and whose loss comes as a sobering reminder that death has no favorites, there are also those in war who are locked in a grim embrace with death from which they cannot escape. He was frightening to behold, a walking corpse. He was shot through the back in a firefight and died in less than a minute. Sigmund Freud divided the forces in human nature between the Eros instinct, the impulse within us that propels us to become close to others, to preserve and conserve, and the Thanatos, or death instinct, the impulse that works towards the annihilation of all living things, including ourselves. For Freud, these forces were in eternal conflict. He was therefore pessimistic about ever eradicating war. All human history, he argued, in civilization and its discontents is a tug of war between these two instincts. Taste enough of war, and you come to believe the Stoics were right. We will, in the end, all consume ourselves in a vast conflagration. There is a constant search in war to find new perversities, new forms of death when the initial flush fades, a rear guard and finally futile effort to ward off the boredom of routine death. And this is why we would drive into towns in Bosnia and find bodies crucified on the sides of barns or decapitated and mutilated. This is why those slain in combat are treated as trophies belonging to the killers, turned into grotesque pieces of performance art. I know soldiers that to this day carry in their wallets the identity cards of men they know they killed. They take them everywhere. They show them to you with the imploring look of a lost child. They will never understand. The job of killing allows our senses to command our bodies. The killing whips fighters into greater orgies of destruction. Hedonism and perversion spirals out of control. Those who worked hard all their lives are reviled as dupes and fools. They haunt the soup kitchens. The loyalty they express to the state or to the institutions they worked for has left them beggars. They collect pensions when they are paid that amount to a few dollars. The normal order is turned upside down. Decency, sobriety, and honesty, moderation no longer pay. Better to give yourself up to the lust of war. In war, we deform ourselves, our essence. We give up individual conscience, maybe even consciousness, for the contagion of the crowd, the rush of patriotism, the belief that we must stand together as a nation in moments of extremity, to make a moral choice, to defy war's enticement, and to defend love can become self-destructive. But in the rise to power, we always become smaller. Power absorbs us, and once power is obtained, we are its pawn. As in Shakespeare's Richard III, the all-powerful prince who molded the world, we fall prey to the forces we thought we had harnessed. Love may not always triumph, but it keeps us human. It offers the only chance to escape from the contagion of war. Perhaps it is the only antidote, and there are times when remaining human is the only victory possible. When the mask of war slips away and the rot and corruption is uncovered, when it turns sour and rank, when the myth is exposed as a fraud, we feel soiled and spent. It is then that we sink into despair. In the Arab-Israeli 1973 war, almost a third of all Israeli casualties were due to psychiatric causes, and the war lasted only a few days. A World War II study determined that after 60 days of continuous combat, 98% of all surviving soldiers will have become psychiatric casualties, and a common trait among the 2% who were able to endure sustained combat was a predisposition towards aggressive, psychopathic personalities. During the war in El Salvador, soldiers could serve in the army for 3 or 4 years or longer, virtually until they psychologically or physically collapsed. In garrison towns, commanders banned the sale of sedatives because of the abuse by troops. In this war, the emotionally maimed were common. I interviewed a 19-year-old Salvadoran army sergeant who had spent 5 years fighting and suddenly lost his vision after his unit walked into a rebel ambush. The rebels killed 11 soldiers in the firefight, including his closest friend. A couple dozen soldiers were wounded. He was unable to see again until he was placed in the army hospital. "I have these horrible headaches," he told me, sitting on the edge of his bed. "There is shrapnel in my head. I keep telling the doctors to take it out." But the doctors told me he had no head wounds. I have seen soldiers in other conflicts go deaf or stop speaking or simply shake without being able to stop. War is necrophilia. And this necrophilia is central to soldiering just as it is central to the makeup of suicide bombers and terrorists. It is hidden under platitudes about duty and comradeship, but it waits, especially in moments when we seem to have little to live for and no hope, or in moments when the intoxication of war is at its pitch to be unleashed. When we spend long enough in war, it comes to us as a kind of release, a fatal and seductive embrace that can consummate the long flirtation with our own destruction. In Milo Vangelis' memoir of the partisan war in Yugoslavia, he wrote of the enticement death held for the combatants. He stood over the body of his comrade, the commander Sava Kovekovich, and found, "Dying did not seem terrible or unjust. This was the most extraordinary, the most exalted moment of my life. Death did not seem strange or undesirable. That I restrained myself from charging blindly into the fray and death was perhaps due to my sense of obligation to the troops or to some comrade's reminder concerning the tasks at hand. In my memory, I returned to those moments many times with the same feeling of intimacy with death and desire for it while I was in prison, especially during my first incarceration." When we see this, when we see our addiction for what it is, when we understand ourselves and how war has perverted us, life becomes hard to bear. John Steele, a cameraman who spent years in war zones, had a nervous breakdown in a crowded Heathrow airport in 1994 after returning from Sarajevo. He understood the reality of his work, a reality that stripped away the self-righteous, high-octane gloss. "I came back from Sarajevo," he said in an interview. "We were in a place called Sniper's Alley. I filmed a girl there who had been hit in the neck by a sniper's bullet. I filmed her in the ambulance, and only after she was dead, I suddenly understood that the last thing she had seen was the reflection of the lens of the camera I was holding in front of her face. This wiped me out. I grabbed the camera and I started running down Sniper's Alley, filming at knee level the Bosnians running from place to place." A year after the war in Sarajevo, I sat with Bosnian friends who had suffered horribly. A young woman, Liliana, had lost her father, a Serb, who refused to join the besieging Serb forces around the city. She had been forced a few days earlier to identify his corpse. The body was lifted, the water running out of the sides of a rotting coffin from a small park for reburial in the central cemetery. She was emigrating for Australia soon, where she told me, "I will marry a man who has never heard of this war and raise children that will be told nothing about it, nothing about the country I am from." Liliana was young, but the war had exacted a toll. Her cheeks were hollow, her hair dry and brittle. Her teeth were decayed and some had broken into jagged bits. She had no money for a dentist. She hoped to fix them in Australia. Yet, all she and her friends did that afternoon was lament the days when they lived in fear and hunger, emaciated, targeted by Serb gunners on the heights above. They did not wish back the suffering, and yet they admitted these may have been the fullest days of their lives. They looked at me in despair. I knew them when they were being pounded by hundreds of shells a day, when they had no water to bathe in or wash their clothes, when they huddled in unheated apartments as sniper bullets hit the walls outside. But what they expressed was real. It was the disillusionment with a sterile, futile, and empty present. Peace had again peeled back the void the rush of war, of battle, had filled. Once again they were, as perhaps we all are, alone, no longer bound by that common sense of struggle, no longer given the opportunity to be noble, heroic, no longer sure what life was about or what it meant. The old comradeship, however false, that allowed them to love men and women they hardly knew, indeed whom they may not have liked before the war, had vanished with the last shot. Moreover, they had seen that all the sacrifice had been for naught. They had been, as we all are in war, betrayed. The corrupt old Communist Party bosses, who became nationalists overnight and got them into the mess in the first place, had grown rich off their suffering and were still in power. There was a 70% unemployment rate. They depended on handouts from the international community. They knew the lie of war, the mockery of their idealism, and struggled with their shattered illusions. They understood that their cause, once as fashionable in certain intellectual circles as they were themselves, lay forgotten. No longer did actors, politicians, and artists scramble to come and visit during the ceasefires, acts that were almost always ones of gross self-promotion. And yet, they wished it all back, and I did too. A year later, I received a Christmas card. It was signed Liliana from Australia. It had no return address. I never heard from her again. But many of those I worked with as war correspondents during the past 20 years did not escape. They could not break free from the dance with death. They wandered from conflict to conflict, seeking always one more hit. By then, I was back in Gaza and found myself pinned down in another ambush. A young Palestinian 15 feet away from me was shot through the chest and killed. I had been lured back, but now felt none of the old rush, just fear. It was time to break free, to let go, to to accept that none of this would or could or should come back. I knew then that it was over. I was lucky to get out alive. Kurt Schork, brilliant, courageous, and driven, could not let go. He died in an ambush in May of 2000 in Sierra Leone, along with another friend, Miguel Gil Moreno. His entrapment, his embrace of Thanatos, of the death instinct, was never questioned at the sterile and antiseptic memorial service staged for him in Washington. Everyone tiptoed around it, but for those of us who knew him, we understood that he had been consumed. I worked with Kurt for 10 years, starting in northern Iraq. Literate, funny, seems the brave are often funny. He and I passed books back and forth in our struggle to make sense of the madness around us. His loss is a hole that will never be filled. His ashes were placed in the Lions Cemetery in Sarajevo for the victims of the war. I flew to Sarajevo and met the British documentary filmmaker Dan Reed. It was an overcast November day. We stood over the grave and downed a pint of whiskey. Dan lit a candle. I recited a poem the Roman lyric poet Catullus had written to honor his dead brother. By strangers, coasts, and waters, many days at sea, I come here for the rites of your unworlding, bringing for you, the dead, these last gifts of the living, and my words, vain sounds for the man of dust. Here are the alas, my brother, you have been taken from me. You have been taken from me by cold chance and turned to shadow and my pain. Here are the foods of the old ceremony, appointed long ago for the starvelings under the earth. Take them. Your brother's tears have made them wet. And take into eternity my hail and my farewell. It was there among a few thousand war dead that Kurt belonged. He died because he could not free himself from war. He was trying to replicate what he had found in Sarajevo, but he could not. War could never be new again. Kurt had been in East Timor and Chechnya. Sierra Leone, I was sure, meant nothing to him. Kurt and Miguel could not let go. They would be the first to admit it. Spend long enough at war, and you cannot fit in anywhere else. It finally kills you. It is not a new story. It starts out like love, but it is death. War is the beautiful young nymph in the fairy tale that, when kissed, exhales the vapors of the underworld. The ancient Greeks had a word for such a fate, ekpyrosis. It means to be consumed by a ball of fire. They used it to describe heroes. Thank you.